morning, everyone, and welcome to Vintage Motocross Radio. I'm your host, Joe Abadi. It's 11 o'clock in Anaheim and about 2 o'clock in Allendale, New Jersey. Thank you again for joining me. If you're listening through Facebook or you're on YouTube, please share the show with your friends. Let them know that we're live here at Vintage Motocross Radio. In a moment, I'm going to have a great guest on. This show, of course, is made possible with the help of our sponsors, Northwest Mako CZ. For all your CZ and Mako needs, please contact Alan Brown. Preston Petty Products, the legend continues. AMSOIL, the first in synthetic oil since 1973. Full Circle Racing, for your rim spokes, lacing, and truing for vintage and modern bikes. Be sure to contact Tom McAllister at Full Circle Racing. Vintco, keep the ride going with over 650 products in their catalog. Motion Pro, for all your specialized tools, cables, and controls, be sure to check out Motion Pro online. This Tuesday, I will be live with Steve Wise. I will be the guest of Steve Wise this Tuesday night. Check with Steve's Facebook page, or I'll be putting up a post shortly letting you know what time that show will begin. In 1993, my guest this morning created a company called Hot Rods from the basement of his parents' house. Within 1 year, he moved to Hot Rods in his parents' basement there into a 1,250-square-foot building. Hot Rod began to grow rapidly, and within 5 years, a master distributor agreement was signed with Weisco Pistons. Hot Rods eventually turned into another company called Hot Cams, and soon other successful ventures were founded, including Cylinder Works, Pivot Works, Wrench Rabbit, and a joint venture in 2009 with Vertex Italy, a company that had been started in 1953, soon began producing pistons in America under the name Vertex USA. For over 28 years, Curtis Leverton had been producing parts for motorcycles and is now a big part of the vintage community and the motocross movement with his latest company, Vintco. It's my pleasure to have with me this morning, Mr. Curtis Leverton. Kurt, are you with me?
Yes, I am. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Yeah, hey, perfect timing. It's -4 out here in Des Moines.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah, there isn't much going on around here today.
No, well, you got the Super Bowl later on today. Will you be watching that?
That is true. That is true.
All right, -4 in Des Moines. Wow. Hey, Kurt, you know, in my research, I discovered that, I guess, of all the motorcycles that are out there, your passion really was for the OSA. Tell us more about that and how you began with old motorcycles.
Yeah, sure. Actually, it was a Christmas gift in 1977. I got a rather dilapidated 1971 OSA Pioneer. I was 13 years old at the time, and that was my first dirt bike. And you know, anybody that rides an old Spanish motorcycle automatically becomes a motorcycle mechanic by nature.
Yeah.
And so it was a great bike for me to learn motorcycle mechanics on. And believe it or not, I still own that bike to this day. I still have my first bike. And I tell you, I wouldn't sell it for the world. All the things. I keep that thing near and dear to me.
What model OSA is that, Kurt?
It's a 71 Pioneer, which was the Enduro bike.
Okay.
And of course, by 1977, when I got the bike, it was completely out of date by 77 standards. But, you know, I was a young kid, and I started getting very interested in the technology around dirt bikes. And, you know, what would I have to do to make a 71 Pioneer a more modern bike? Well, of course, we all know there's nothing to be done about it, but I didn't know that at the time. So it was a good study for me to try to figure out what I could do to improve that bike to make it a little bit more competitive with modern bikes.
Did you ride the bike competitively, Kurt? Did you have it in enduros or any motocross?
Yeah, so when I was a kid, my dad said, you can ride all you want, but I refuse to let you race.
Yeah.
So I was not allowed to race until I reached the age of consent. And then at that point, I started racing one of the ARMA series. Of course, I went to college and ended up getting my degree. And then when I got out of college, I got more serious about racing vintage and did a fair amount of motocross and ARMA trials. To be honest, trials is a lot of fun. I really enjoyed riding trials bikes.
Okay. So there really wasn't much of a competitive nature with you from when you got the bike in 77 until ARMA became popular many years later.
Yes. So I really went a long time. And then ARMA came around. And I thought, well, I'll try my hand at some vintage racing. And I definitely enjoyed that quite a bit. And today I still, you know, I race modern, hair scrambles on occasion. I might do one or two of them a year. And I promised myself here that I'm going to start racing more vintage motocross. So that's kind of my promise to myself over the next couple of years.
Yeah, for me too. You know, I was doing it for a while from 99 till 2009, and then I stopped, and I'm getting the urge again to get out there and race some of the old bikes. So did you have friends growing up there, Kurt, that had bikes back there? This is in Iowa, I'm guessing?
Yes, the dirt bike capital of the world, Iowa. Yes, I did have quite a few friends that I rode with, and of course they've either passed away or they've just no longer interested in riding dirt bikes. But all I say is all you have to do in Iowa is own a dirt bike and have some land, and you'll have plenty of friends.
Yeah.
So I still ride today. I have a nice riding facility here in Iowa. It was a Loretto Lynn's qualifying track, and about 250 acres of riding. So I get out and ride quite a bit. I mostly ride modern bikes. I'll ride a vintage bike on occasion. Here sometimes the ground can be kind of rough here. In fact, the video that I did for Vinco, that was on my Osa Super Pioneer. Mm-hmm. And I rode that, we rode about 2.5 hours to get all those shots in there. And I almost couldn't walk for 3 days after I got off that bike.
So, you know, let's get back there for a second, Kurt. I mean, you got an Osa Pioneer in 77, but what was that aha moment for you that said, you know, dirt bikes, this is for me? Was there other sports you were interested in, or?
Yeah, you know, I tell you, I only had a passion for dirt bikes. I was absolutely obsessed about dirt bikes. I rode dirt bikes every single night after school. Mm-hmm. I would ride year round, even in the winter. I was just obsessed with it. And not once did I ever think to myself to make a living in the dirt bike industry. Never crossed my mind. It wasn't until I went to, until I met my wife in college that she's the one that said, well, why don't you come up with an idea and start a business? And I thought, well, I never even thought about doing anything like that. She goes, well, come up with something. So I did. I came up with a motorcycle dirt bike business. And it kind of went well after that.
It sure did. So what did you study in college? Because I'm interested in knowing something what didn't have anything to do with motorcycles. So what did you do there?
Yeah, my degree was in engineering. My bachelor's, and I got my master's in business. And it was one of the few times I ever listened to my dad. He said, son, it's nice to have an engineering degree, but you really need to have a business degree. And I thought, well, maybe he's right about that. And so I went to college to get my MBA, and that's where I met my wife, and, you know, it kind of got the idea to start the business. But my college career was pretty rough. I was put on academic probation when I was getting my engineering degree, and I ended up moving furniture and ran a jackhammer for about a year. And I think that jackhammer is the one that made me, sent me back to college. It's pretty tough running a jackhammer.
So you founded several successful companies over the years, and your theory always was to think like a customer. What was the first part that you made and got out there on the market? You say your wife really prompted you to do that. What was the first product it came out with?
It was connecting rods, and it was completely related to an OSA. OSAs are famous for having poor connecting rods. In their flat track bikes, you might get 45 minutes out of an OSA connecting rod. And there was a Yamaha YA6 connecting rod, a conversion that you could install in an OSA that was very reliable. And that was the impetus. She said, "Well, come up with something." And I thought, "Well, let's see about finding this connecting rod." And we did. And I brought them. Got some of them. Brought them here to the United States. Sold them. I brought 50 of them in. I sold all of them just immediately. And then I bought another 100. Brought them in. Sold them immediately. And then I took that money, and we built a Boltaco rod, a Boltaco 250. And I called Hugh Weaver at Hughes Boltaco.
Sure.
And I said, "Hey, I've got these. I got some Boltaco connecting rods." He goes, "I'll take them all." And after that, I said to my wife, I go, you know, we might be on to something here. So it was the connecting rod business, and it started off in the vintage market, and then we parlayed it up into the modern bikes.
What made your rod better, Kurt?
Well, it was just a better design. I mean, a big part of the connecting rod design changes were in the early 90s, and it was the bearing designs. Bearing designs made a big step forward. Without boring, you know, everybody listening, there is a significant change in the way connecting rod bearings were designed in the 90s, and it was quite an improvement. And so we would implement these design changes in the connecting rods that would make the rod a better a better product.
So it was in the bearing, or was it in the thickness of the rod as well?
Well, it's actually a combination of a couple things. It was in the bearing. There's a type of bearing called a Sigma profile, which is the older bearings that they used in the 70s. And then around 1991, 92, 93, they went to a flat profile cage. And the flat profile cage is the separator that separates the needle rollers. It was flat all the way across. And it allows you to get an extra 1 to 2 extra needle rollers in there. And it also made for cage. It was just a stronger piece. And that was a big improvement. And then there's some there was little vent slots that you could put in connecting rods. And some of the design changes that happened in that period were big improvements. And we implemented those features in our connecting rods.
Tell me this. Now, you're obviously using a Vinco connecting rod in your OSA. How long has it been in there? Tell me about the reliability of it. How long have you used one now?
Well, mine was a copy of the, if you go back to what was the original rod I put in there, it's been in there for 30 years now. the two strokes are really, without getting a lot technical, the two strokes are actually not too hard on connecting rods. Four strokes are hard on connecting rods. A two stroke rod always has pressure on top of the piston, so it's always kind of being pushed down. Even when you chop the throttle, there is still pressure on top of the piston, so you don't get a lot of tensile stress in a connecting rod. Whereas in a four stroke, every other cycle during the exhaust stroke, you have a big tensile load on there. And so you're trying to pull the rod apart, and then you're trying to push it back together, as it's going through its power stroke.
Yeah.
And so two stroke rods just don't go through the type of stress that a four stroke connecting rod does. So it's pretty straightforward to make a reliable two stroke rod. Of course, you can always plan on someone mixing oil wrong or not running a filter. Or actually, one of the worst things for connecting rods today is fuels with ethanol. Every year at Hot Rods, we'd have this little rash about February, where we'd start see these rod failures. And I'm like, took me years to figure out what was going on. And I'm like, why do we always get this rash in February? And what it turns out is that's when a lot of people would put their bikes away with ethanol fuels. They let them sit for 2 or 3 months, and then that ethanol would wreak havoc on the connecting rod bearing. And then when they would go to start it, there'd be rust on the needle rollers, and that was the end of the connecting rod.
Wow. That's really something to consider for anybody listening out here who is restoring or rebuilding bikes, how ethanol gas. I know, as a guy who fixes gas tanks, and it's a big part of my income, I see so many tanks, or people ask me about liners or fiberglass tanks, and the ethanol gas has just, as you say, wreaked havoc with so many different parts on a bike.
So. Yeah. Well, with Hot Rods, at the time that I sold the company, we'd sold over 1 million connecting rods. So I'd seen about every failure known to man that can happen with a connecting rod. And it took me a while to piece that one together. It's like, why do we always get this rash? And then I started realizing what was going on with them. So ethanol, I mean, it's okay to run ethanol, but you don't want to stop the bike and let it sit in there. That's what you don't want to do.
Let's talk about Vinco a little bit, Kurt. They had over 650 products in their catalog, and I'm wondering who decides what the next product will be, who develops it, and are all your prototypes made in-house?
Yeah, good question. So the process of development, I mean, we obviously have a strategy. We're trying to fill in bikes from the 70s and then also starting from the 80s. Now, I have a non-compete with my previous company that I could not do anything after 1981. That's why when people go to the website, we'll have stuff that will say 1981. And a lot of people go, well, this will fit an 82 or an 83. And we say, well, we can't tell anybody that. Uh-huh. We have to keep that quiet because that's part of our non-compete. But anyway, so the strategy is to try to fill out stuff from the 70s and stuff from the 80s as much as possible. I also get a lot of feedback from customers who are always telling me, hey, you thought about making this, there's a demand for this. And I go out and research. But certainly people's input, customers' input is a big part of what we develop.
Okay. And you do that in-house. I mean, you'll make that part before
We do all the design work is done internally. This is one of the epiphanies I had with my old company. You have to have drawings and you have to have engineering drawings because you can't have inspection if you don't have engineering drawings. That is a very critical element. A lot of people, when they make things, in today's world, they just kind of send it over to some company to have them manufacture it. That company does the drawings and applies their own standards of tolerancing on there and does their own inspection. Well, that's kind of like letting the fox, you know, guard the hen's house.
Sure.
And so you can't do that. So you have to have your own engineering drawings, and then that way you have your own internal inspection process. It's critical. It's probably the most important thing that we ever did at my old place that allowed the company to grow so much was drawings with our own inspection department.
How many people do you employ at Vinco?
Well, Vinco right now has 5 employees, counting myself and my wife.
Mm-hmm.
My old business, C&L, we had about, before I sold it, we were very close to 200.
Now, see, let's talk about C&L for a second then. Was that the umbrella company for Wrench Rabbit and the cylinder company and all the other companies?
Cylinder Works. Yeah, I forget them all. And Vertex Pistons and Hot Rods and Piddle Works and Wrench Rabbit. Yeah, we had quite a few. That was started with my wife and I. Again, that was what her suggestion was. Hey, why don't we start, come up with some idea. And then we just kind of grew the company. And then we started realizing these other opportunities with different brands.
Mm-hmm.
And then we developed those. And so we had a pretty good staff of people there that could get these products done.
I see. Well, what's your best-selling product there at Vinco?
For sure, the piston kits.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure, pistons. And then second would be connecting rods.
Okay.
Pistons are number one. That's what people need. And then connecting rods. It's not uncommon for someone to have a connecting rod after a bike's been sitting for so many years and gets a little bit of water inside of it. Those rods are shot.
While we're talking about pistons, I speak to your associate there, Jay. I speak to him once a month regarding products for our showcase on Vintage Motocross Q&A, and he tells me, of all the things you see returned, well, you don't see that many returns, he tells me. But what you do see returned are pistons that are the incorrect size. What can you suggest that people do? I mean, obviously, other than know how to measure a bore or a piston, but what are some things that you could suggest to the people listening that ensure they get the right size piston?
So let me comment that the pistons are not incorrectly sized. The person incorrectly measured them.
Yes.
When he placed the order. I think the biggest problem, and what ends up happening is someone, they don't quite know how to measure it, or they don't know what oversize they're on. But the biggest problem is the bore doesn't clear up or clean up after it gets bored.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're stuck. And so I think the solution to this is a person, one of the great things about modern pistons is they're made so accurately now that you could send the cylinder out and just have it bored to a certain size, whatever it cleans up, and then order your piston afterwards. So I think, the old way it used to be was you buy a piston. Of course, they were so hideously oversized back in the 70s and the 80s that the machinist would fit the piston to the cylinder. Well, you don't have to do that anymore. You can just send your cylinders off to your machine shop, have them bored, tell your machinist to bore them out to whatever size. It will clean it up, and then you can order the appropriate piston that will fit that afterwards.
Okay, so I'm a little confused on that because and I'll tell you why. And for the people that are listening, maybe they have the same question. What you're actually saying is to drill the hole before you know what size the screw is. Technically, I mean, If I'm on a stock bore of whatever bike and there's some scoring in it, I'm just going to tell my machinist, take out that scoring. Then I'm going to call you and order a piston.
Well, obviously you're going to have to look at what sizes we have available. So we might have a half a millimeter over,
okay,
1 millimeter over, 1.5 millimeter over. You need to tell the machinist, look, I only have 3 choices. I can only put a half,
okay,
a 1 or a 1.5 in there. Bore it out to the least number,
right?
And then let me know what that is. And once they bore that out, and what's nice is they can bore it exactly half a millimeter over,
mm-hmm,
1 millimeter over, or 1.5 millimeters over, and the piston clearance will be exact.
Okay.
When you install it, that's the nice thing about that, about modern pistons,
right,
today.
So they still need to look at what size you offer before.
Yes, correct.
Okay, I'm clear on that.
Yes.
Now. Are your pistons?
Sorry.
The Vinco pistons, are they still made in Italy by Vertex?
No, they're made by Wasner in Germany right now. That's obviously I contacted Vertex and I said, hey, I'd like to, buy these pistons from you. And they said, well, being that they're cast pistons from Italy, they have very large production runs. And so I said, well, I'm not going to be able to, I can't buy that many of them, for all these different motors. And I want your blessing because Vertex and Wasner are somewhat competitive with each other. And I said, I want your blessing that I can buy them from Wozner. And he said, that's fine. I understand why you have to do it.
Okay.
So I've been buying these pistons from Wozner. They do a great job and nice people to work with.
You know, I don't have this on my list of questions and whatnot. And I don't want to open up a can of worms, but I think it's a good question. Well, why didn't you go to Weisco?
Well, that is a can of worms.
Okay.
I get along with, you know, I had a relationship with Weisco. Hot Rods and Weisco were married. We had the best way to say it is that Weisco and Hot Rods were married for many years, and then we had a divorce. And you know, it's even though I get along with everybody and I'm cordial with Weisco, it's just, I guess it's not on my list of somebody that I would work with again.
Okay.
That was a can of worms, and I'm trying to be political as I can about it, but it was an ugly divorce. I'll just leave it at that.
I'm gonna cover the can of worms and we're gonna move on.
Yeah.
Rumor has it that Vinco will be reproducing Fox Air Shocks in the very near future. Can you confirm that?
Yeah, that is true. That is true. We should, I think, we'll, of course, ever the optimist, I want to say we're going to have our first, our first production pieces in 30 days, but I think it's probably going to be more than likely. Mm-hmm. It's going to be more than likely 60 days, I think, before we'll start having them in stock.
Okay. Now, do you have to get rights from that or from like Bob Fox?
No,
or how does that
because work? Any patents would be done at the end of 17 years. So regardless, you know, it's been so many years now that regardless of the patents, there wouldn't be any today.
Okay. Can we expect to see other suspension parts from Vinco in the future?
Yeah, I think, we'll see where this all goes. I mean, yeah, you know, it's kind of, sometimes you're fishing, you throw stuff out in the market, you kind of see where it goes, and then you make your decisions on, you know, how to expand the product line after that. I'd like to put more modern valving in there. I mean, right now the air shock that we're producing is an exact duplicate of the original Fox air shock. Every component is completely the same, so everything will be interchangeable. So if a customer would happen to have a set of original shocks and maybe you need some shafts or whatever it may be, well, we'd have the shafts available. But I would like to make a little bit more modern valving piston than what's in that the Fox shock, the original design.
Okay. What about forks? You think you'll ever do anything with forks?
I don't know. That sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah.
So I don't know yet. I mean, those Simons forks sure look nice, don't they?
But yeah.
You know, again, it's kind of all a matter of we have to see how well this moves. I mean, if it moves real well, then I would certainly take a look at that.
You know, Kurt, you and I were talking about the vintage bikes throughout this conversation. You say how your body hurts for 3 days after you ride one. And I have to agree with that. How will Vinco remain relevant in the market as younger guys become interested in what they consider vintage bikes? You know, there's guys out there 35 to 45 years old. They want to ride late model 80s, early 90s bikes. Is Vinco going to jump into that market too?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. In fact, that's part of the strategy. You know, I'm like, for example, I love Osas. You know, that's a bike that's near and dear to me. But, you know, all of us are going to start aging out of that group. And same thing with the Hidakas and the Voltacos. And though I think it's going to be many, many years before we really see those things, you know, people age out of that. But that's the reality of what's going on with that. Well, that's one of the great things about Vinco. It's not stuck in, you know, that range from when the Hidakas were made or when the Osas were being made. Or Voltacos. Vinco can move on up into the 80s, and then it can move into the 90s. I mean, as I like to say, they're making a new vintage dirt bike every day.
Yeah.
You know, the 2022 KTMs are someday going to be a vintage dirt bike.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's always good. So Vinco should always be able to straddle and just keep moving up. And that's part of the strategy. Make parts for bikes from the 70s, make them from the 80s, make them from the 90s, and that's the direction we're going.
Let's go back for a second and talk about this company, because I the name is interesting, Wrench Rabbit. How did that come about, and did you just rebrand or remarket what you already had under Wrench Rabbit? How did all that come together?
So I think even in my days at Weisco, I think we all recognize that anybody that could put a complete engine rebuild in the box is going to dominate the world. Because it's just so much work for an engine, for any dealership to go through and pick out every single part, every seal, every O-ring, every bearing, so much work. And so if you could create that one item where everything was all in a box, you would dominate the world of engine rebuildings. And so we had the crankshafts, we had the piston factory, we had all the bearings, and all the seals all put together. We had the gaskets. We had a pretty good setup there. And so we were able to introduce that product line. Of course, the name wrench, obviously, is working on stuff. And rabbits are smart and quick.
Yeah.
And so we tried to convey that, hey, this is a smart, quick way to do engine rebuild. And of course, it took off really well because dealerships could quote a customer so quickly when they came to the parts counter. Like, how much is it going to cost me to rebuild this? They could look up the wrench rabbit kit. They would tack on $400 labor or whatever it was, and they could give a guy a quote right there on the spot.
Mm.
And so it really took off well, as we all planned on doing.
Yeah. Now, what about the four-stroke vintage market, Kurt? Do you do anything there?
Not yet. No. Right now, I've been kind of just focused on two-strokes. We'll probably have to address the four-stroke market someday, but at this time, it's pretty much two-strokes. And, during this whole four-stroke, two-stroke, drama that's gone on since about 97 or 98,
right.
I've had my fair share of four-strokes and two-strokes. And, at the end of the day, I got to say, I think I'm a two-stroke guy. And so I tend to focus on those things.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Something else that's, I think, has affected a lot of people in all sorts of different ways. And I was speaking to Chris Carter from Motion Pro recently, and he said he has seen a huge surge in sales since this whole COVID thing has hit. How has it affected Vinco?
Yeah, so there's no question COVID has been fantastic for the dirt bike industry.
Mm.
Dirt bike industry is doing extremely well. From what I'm gathering, it's somewhere around 50% up from what it was over the previous year, give or take a little bit. And it's obviously because it's an outdoor activity and it's a family activity. And so it's driving people outdoors because they can't really be indoors.
Mm-hmm.
As far as Vinco is concerned, because I don't have enough historical data to be able to say what's going on. I mean, obviously our sales are up and we're doing much better than we were a year ago, but that's also part of the natural growth phase of a growing business. And so I can't give any solid numbers to how well things are going. But talking to other people in the industry, it sounds like the market's up about 50% from what it's been in the past.
Are you having a problem with your manufacturer making parts fast enough?
Yes and no. Actually, the shocks have been the biggest struggle for us because there has been so many people that the manufacturing has gotten so busy around the world that we've had some issues getting shock components made, but we're doing okay on the pistons, and that seems to be fine. And the connection rods were okay too.
What is Fuel Star? Is that a
Fuel Star was an old, every fuel valve on a dirt bike is, especially an older one, is all, they don't work or they're leaking. I mean, how many times you came out of your shop, found a whole bunch of oil or gas spilled all over the floor, and your cylinder completely filled with fuel?
Sure.
That happens all the time, and so that was where we thought, hey, why don't we start making these things? And so we started manufacturing fuel valves. And let me tell you, those things are a major pain in the butt. I had no idea what a nightmare making a fuel valve was going to be, especially the ones at Suzuki's that have a little vacuum that would open the fuel valve. There's a certain vacuum that you have to have on there, otherwise that fuel valve will shut. So you can imagine the liability of someone riding down the street, and he doesn't have, maybe he doesn't have enough vacuum there to open up the diaphragm to turn the fuel on. The guy runs out of fuel while he's going down the highway, and he gets ran over or whatever.
Sure.
So it really ended up being a tough, painful business to be in, I can tell you that.
Is that still going on? You still do that?
Yeah. As far as I know, it is. I really don't know. That was part of the, when I sold the company, that was one of the companies that went with it. And so I don't really know what they're doing with that anymore.
Okay. Well, you mentioned that you ride modern bikes. What modern, do you ride modern street bikes or just modern off-road bikes?
No, I do my off-road bikes. I have a KTM. I tend to ride predominantly KTMs. I do have a Yamaha, the new four-stroke. I have a 2020 KTM, the TPI, the fuel-injected bike, and then the new YZ250FX. Both of them are great bikes, but at the end of the day, like I said, I'm kind of a two-stroke guy, so I that tends to be what I ride. I still ride my Osa Phantom, and I ride my Super Pioneer on occasion. As far as street bikes are concerned, I'm a Moto Guzzi guy and the new V85 TT.
Oh.
The adventure touring market that is made for us older dirt bike riders. If you're an older dirt bike rider, you are going to love ADP bikes. They are just, I really enjoy it. My buddies get together. There's lots of gravel travel here in Iowa, and we have B-level roads here, which are unmaintained roads, which can be pretty rough, and it's really fun. So ADV riding has turned out to be something a bug that I've caught here in the last couple of years.
I see. You know, Kurt, I've always loved Italian exotic cars, and I think we share that passion. Can you tell me more about this Alfa Romeo Tipo you own? How long have you owned it? How'd you get into the Alfa Romeos?
Yeah, so this goes to show you how dumb I am about, you know, investing in racing racing cars. You know, I was talking to someone that I said, hey, I think maybe I'd like to vintage race cars. You know, you got any ideas? They said, yeah, why don't you look, you know, at an Alfa Romeo Tipo 33. And for those not familiar, the Tipo 33s competed against the Porsche 917s in a world sports car in 69, 70, 71. They were a world sports car, which was basically countries, governments going to war with each other in the racing, in the racing venue.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up finding one over in Belgium and brought it over here, and you know, and then I started realizing this is not the car you start out with to start racing, but it ended up being a very good investment when it was all done. But I got into a lower level car that wasn't quite as fast, started, you know, cutting my teeth on that process, but now that I've been doing it for about 7 years, I actually do race the Tipo on occasion. I got a couple other vintage race cars that I do. I've really enjoyed that. I think that people that ride dirt bikes are going to be naturally good at racing a car because there's one skill that we all possess that is just invaluable for racing a car, and that is we counter steer with our butt.
Yeah.
The moment we feel the back end of that bike slipping, we immediately counter steer.
Uh-huh.
And as I've discovered, that's a skill that dirt bike riders possess, but it's not something that a lot of other people possess. And so when you go around a corner, you can feel the back end of that car starting to swing out because you're putting the car at the limit. You have an absolutely natural instinct to counter steer, and it's invaluable for racing.
Now, you mentioned you own some other cars too, other than the Alfa Romeo. What other cars do you have?
Well, I got into this, you know, as investing. So I bought back when they were much more affordable. I got into buying a Ferrari Daytona,
okay,
which is a pretty affordable car at the time. And then the market values just exploded. I just got lucky on that thing. And so I started to invest more and more into cars. And it's been a pretty good, a pretty good venue to invest in because the car market has gone up. And it's been pretty good for me. And by the way, I think something that I do want to touch on is that, and that's about investing in vintage dirt bikes right now.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
You know, I do think that, you know, with what's going on, probably with the new regime change, that having money put in assets, you know, tangible assets, cars, motorcycles, paintings, even some real estate, I think those are good places to put your money right now. And I watch the car auctions pretty closely. The market's starting to move up again, and I can assure you that whatever the car market does, the motorcycle market always follows afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I hear people complaining about the costs of vintage dirt bikes and how expensive they are. Well, I think if you're interested in getting one, you better do it now because I think you're going to be in for a shock where they're going to go here in a couple of years from now.
I agree. What do you think would be some of the marks that people are really going to be paying attention to? We've seen the RH67. We've heard about the YZ360. What are some other ones you're thinking might be a good place to put your money at this time?
Well, I think there's always two ways to look at this. There's the blue chip things, which are stuff that nobody denies is world class, like a Baco 498. I think that's, you know, that's going to go down as history as one of the greatest bikes. So any of those blue chip things. But there's also the bikes of the people that are involved, their age group. So obviously bikes from the 80s,
mm-hmm,
which, you know, it's probably in my particular age group. I'm a twin shock guy. I tend to like bikes that are twin shock. I'm not so much into the vintage monoshock bikes. So there's some I like. But I think you're going to see that those monoshock bikes are going to be the ones that are probably going to start moving up because that's the age group that's going to be coming into the market next.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think even the 90s. So I just think you're going to see things start to creep up. Certainly the 80s, I think, are going to go first, and then it won't be long before you see the bikes from the 1990s following through as this catches on. I think one of the biggest things we're missing in the vintage market is a little more exposure, a lot more exposure, actually, because I look at it this way, Kurt. You go to a Supercross race, there's 35, 45, 50,000 people there, and they're all there to watch the, you know, the Villopotos or the Tomacs or whoever may be popular at that time. But you're not going to tell me that every guy in there knows anything about the older bikes. There's a lot of young people in there. And I think the nostalgia bug is going to hit them eventually if they knew a little bit more about it.
Yeah.
You know,
well, it always does. And there's no, people always, as everybody ages, we all become interested in history.
Yeah.
It's a natural instinct for every human walking this planet. That as you get a little older, you always become a little bit more interested in history. So I think that's, there's no question that that's going to happen.
Do you watch Supercross or modern motocross?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I watch it. I watched Mr. Roczen last night, win. And, you know, I think everybody's rooting for that, for him, just because of everything he's been through. It'd be great to see him come back from that level of injury and to win a championship. I think it'd be fantastic.
I agree with that. And I think there's a lot of people in his corner. And, you know, America loves a comeback story. No question about that.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about your family a little bit, Kurt. How long have you been married? How many children do you have?
So I've been married for, let's see here, 20 years now. Mm-hmm. And I have a couple grandkids that we raise here at the house. And I really enjoy it. I mean, you know, we took on that responsibility. It's like, yeah, maybe it'd be best we raise the grandkids. And quite honestly, it keeps me young. And I absolutely love it. It doesn't, I don't feel like I'm missing anything. I love spending time with them. And of course, I'm teaching them how to ride dirt bikes. Got to do that.
Yeah.
I try to make them watch Supercross, but, you know, they're pretty young. And they're like, okay, they'd rather go play on a computer or something than sit around and watch Supercross. But I really enjoy it. It's been a great experience. And of course, my wife, you know, we were in business together, and she's the one that talked me into this. And, you know, I consider myself an A-plus personality, but my wife's an A++. She was a very hard driver in that company, and she was instrumental in getting that company to the size that it was, because she had a lot of great connections, and she was a very hardworking person. And so it's kind of time for her to relax a little bit. I mean, she still handles Binco stuff, but not to the level that it was when it was back in C&L days.
Right. Hey, Kurt, you know, you're from Iowa. You went to school in Iowa. Were all that was Vinco and all the other companies, were they always based in Iowa?
Yes. They all came from Iowa, with the exception of Vertex Piston. That was out of Italy.
Okay. And what about some other interests or hobbies aside from motorcycles or cars, if that's even possible?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, that's an all consuming thing, but now I play guitar. I've been a guitar player for about 40 years, and I, you know, that's one of my other little hobbies. And, you know, I always keep a guitar right next to my desk so I could stop and kind of relax and play. And I don't know, there's something about playing music that seems to fire every synapse in your mind. It's great. I'm glad I do that. I love working on motorcycles. I mean, I've always liked mechanical things. I cannot stand chasing up electrical problems. I hate electrical problems.
I'm with you on that one. That's why I don't work on street bikes. That's the number one reason why.
Yeah, I know. I get rather aggravated when I have to start chasing down electrical problems.
Yeah.
I love doing the mechanical work on bikes, but not electrical.
Well, we're just about out of time for today, Kurt. I want to give you an opportunity to either thank someone, or we could go back and revisit anything that we haven't covered so far. If there's anything we missed from a little bit earlier, let's go back and talk about that. Is there anything on your mind?
Well, I certainly have to thank my wife. I mean, I think I've always kind of been the figurehead in the industry, but because I'm the dirt bike rider and all that. Of course, but anybody that really knows the dynamic that went on, how the company grew, everybody knows that my wife had a major, probably a more important element to growing the company. She used to like to say, I lay the eggs, but then she ends up hatching them. And that's absolutely what happened. And also, though, another thing I always thank is the employees I had at C&L. You know, it is impossible to grow a company of that size without having a phenomenal staff. And as you develop a company, your job, you know, my job as the owner, was really to make sure that I had a great group of people that had a good dynamic that was going on. And it becomes more about managing that dynamic to make sure. And I tell you, I have just phenomenal people. And lots of them were dirt bike riders, and they got it. And I loved how they would argue with me about stuff. I had one employee in particular that was just always in my face about the decisions. He never argued anything for himself. He only argued for what was best for the company. No matter how irritated I got with him, I really appreciated that dynamic. That was, he fought for the company, and boy, he'd go down swinging for what was best for the company. And I really liked that, even though we got into some pretty good spats over the years. Well, that was invaluable.
Yeah, you've obviously chosen a good staff, and that's what you need. You know, what is the old saying about a smart general surrounds himself with good people or something like that?
But, smarter ones.
Smarter
that's
ones,
what he
yeah.
Meant, smarter ones.
Yeah. Well, Kurt, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us here at Vintage Motocross Radio today. I also want to thank you again for your support for Vintage Motocross Q&A. And, you know, you were one of my first sponsors. You've been there for us every month. Your products are fantastic. And I just wanted to take an opportunity to thank you for that as well.
Well, thank you, Joe. You do a phenomenal job. Fantastic. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. My guest this morning has been Kurt. Is it Leverton or Leverton?
It's actually Leverton.
It is Leverton.
Yes, Leverton.
Okay. Curtis Leverton, thank you so much. I'll be in touch.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now. My guest this morning has been Curtis Leverton. We had a good conversation about Vinco and some of the other companies he's been involved with over the years. The show today, Vintage Motocross Radio, has been brought to you by Northwest Mako CZ. For all your Mako and CZ parts, please contact Alan Brown. Preston Petty Products. Thank you, Paul Standard and Patty. The legend continues at Preston Petty Products. Visit them online. AMSOIL, the first in synthetic oil since 1973. Thank you, Russell Waters. Full Circle Racing. Tom McAllister, for your rim spokes, lacing, and truing needs for vintage and modern bikes, be sure to contact Full Circle Racing. Motion Pro, for all your specialized tools, cables, and controls, visit them online at motionpro.com. Once again, I will be the guest of Steve Wise this coming Tuesday night. Stay tuned to Vintage Motocross Q&A or Vintage Motocross Radio or my personal page, and you'll find out about the time that is going to happen. I'll be with Steve Wise Tuesday night. This is Joe Abadi. Thank you for tuning in today to Vintage Motocross Radio. Enjoy the rest of your day, the Super Bowl, if you're into that, and whatever else you're doing. Thanks for listening. Speak to you soon.